In their desperate search for news, other wives made the mistake of tuning in Japanese stations. Mrs. W.G. Beecher heard that her husband's destroyer Flusser had been sunk with the entire Lexington task force. Mrs. Arthur Farner, wife of Hickam's mess supervisor, didn't need to fish for news. She knew all too well. Someone had told her of the bomb that hit the Hickam mess hall, said no one escaped alive. She took it for granted that Sergeant Farner died at his post, and now her job was to get the 5 children back to the mainland, into school, and find a way to support them. The Farners had been evacuated to the University of Hawaii Auditorium, and while the Red Cross performed miracles, there still weren't enough cots for the scores of families that sprawled on the floor. Sunday night, Mrs. Farner and 3 other mothers formed a hollow square of adults and dumped their 10 children in the middle. This at least kept them in one spot, but it still was a night of whimpering, of restless tossing, of endless trips to the bathroom over and around sleeping people. Just when everything quieted down, some new disturbance would break out. One little girl lost a kitty with a bell around its neck. Soon it was hard to tell which caused the most commotion, the cat roaming and ringing its bell or the child calling and searching in the dark. The little girl had a way of turning up wherever the kitty had just left. Slowly the hours dragged by. The children gradually dozed off, but the mothers were wide-eyed all night. Sometimes they talked together, other times they just lay quietly holding one another's hands, waiting for daylight. The mothers were busier in the Navy storage tunnel at Red Hill, where other families were evacuated. Clouds of mosquitoes swarmed down the air vents, and the women spent most of the night shooing them off so their children could sleep. Then an unexpected crisis arose. One young mother forgot to bring any bottles for her month-old baby. Cups were tried, but of course the baby was too young. Someone suggested a sugar shaker, but the spout was too large. Finally, Mrs. Alexander Rowell came up with the solution. She soaked a clean rag in milk and let the baby suck on it. That was what the pioneers did, she explained. She had read all about it in Drums Along the Mohawk. Generous people opened up their homes to other evacuees. One Navy commander's wife at Waipahu took in 20 or 30 women and children, including Don and Jerry Morton and their mother, Mrs. Croft. Everyone made a point of being cheerful, but the rumors were frightening. It was said resistance was weak against the enemy advance from Kaneohe. Some of the mothers talked as though they were already prisoners, but Don and Jerry vowed to take to the hills and fight to the end. Here and there, a few families stubbornly refused to evacuate. Mrs. Arthur Gardner had no great faith in the construction of the junior officers' duplex quarters near Makalapa, but it was home, and she wanted to be there when Lieutenant Gardner returned. She pushed the dining room table against a wall, dragged 4 mattresses downstairs with the help of 5-year-old Keith. She placed them strategically around the shelter and crawled in with Keith and 2-year-old Susan. Keith was sick with worry and excitement, but tried wonderfully to cooperate. Susan was in open rebellion and went along only when convinced it was part of a new game. Mrs. Paul Spangler thought it might help to read to her 4 children as they sat in their blacked-out living room on Aleva Heights. So she rigged her coat over a floor lamp, gathered everybody around her, and picked up a book. Instantly, a man was pounding on the door, shouting, "Put out that light!" She gave up, and they all went to bed. Navy wife Lorraine Campbell dealt more successfully with the blackout at her home near Pearl Harbor. She turned off all the lights and put a Band-Aid on the radio dial. Some blackout problems were insurmountable. As Alan Mao, a 12-year-old Hawaiian, tried to make cocoa for the evacuees at his home, he found he couldn't get the milk out of the refrigerator without turning on the automatic light inside. He could get his hand in all right, but not out, with the milk bottle too. Finally, he went ahead anyhow, and almost lost his arm when the whole family dived at the door to shut the light off. In the darkness, many turned their thoughts to the men who had rushed off in the morning. Days would pass before most of the families heard of them again. On Tuesday, Mrs. Arthur Farner learned that a box of chocolate bars had mysteriously appeared at a friend's house, usually a sure sign that Sergeant Farner had been around. Yet she scarcely dared to hope. The following day, she found out. The sergeant had been in the bakery getting bread when the Hickam mess hall was hit. He escaped without a scratch. On Wednesday, Nurse Monica Conter still had no word of Lieutenant Benning, but she was doing her best to carry on. As she walked down the 3rd-floor corridor of the Hickam Hospital, the elevator door opened, and there he was in full combat uniform, looking even dirtier than any soldier she had seen in the movies. It was Thursday morning when Mrs. Joseph Coate heard the chaplain call her name at the university auditorium. She slipped into the ladies' room and prayed for the strength to bear the bad news. When she emerged, the chaplain told her Chief Coate was fine. Later that day, Mrs. W.G. Wallace was back on her civilian job at Pearl Harbor, trying not to look out the window at the charred ships that depressed her so. But a familiar shadow passed the window, and she instinctively looked up. It was her husband, Ensign Wallace, last seen Sunday morning. She threw herself across the desk, halfway through the window and into his arms. Then they slipped into the first aid shack, where no one could see them, and cried. It wasn't until Monday, December 14th, that Don and Jerry Morton learned their stepfather had been killed on the seaplane ramp at Ford Island by one of the first bombs to fall. But the waiting, the gnawing uncertainty, all lay ahead. This black Sunday night, the families on Oahu had other worries. In the eerie darkness, Japanese seemed to lurk behind every bush. Betty and Margot Spangler, two teenage sisters, normally slept out on the lanai, but this night they took over their mother's bed. Mrs. W.G. Beecher got her children to sleep, lay awake herself, listening uneasily as the palm trees brushed against the side of the house. Navy wife Reba Wallace took in a frightened single girl who insisted she heard someone on the roof. Mrs. Wallace spied a rifle in the corner, promised to shoot both the girl and herself if the Japanese came in. This was somehow reassuring. The girl calmed down, and Mrs. Wallace kept it to herself that the gun wasn't loaded. Mrs. Patrick Gillis, a young army wife, was sure she saw someone skulking outside her apartment house. So did the other five wives who had joined her. The police combed the grounds in vain. About 4 a.m., another alarm went direct to Colonel Fielder in the intelligence office at Fort Shafter. Someone was signaling with a blue light up behind the base. Fielder grabbed a pistol, a helmet, and a sentry. Sure enough, a light was flashing up the mountain. He called for reinforcements, and the squad deployed through buffalo grass, crossed a stream, surrounded the area, and moved in. Two elderly farmers were milking a cow, using a blue light as instructed. A palm frond swaying in the breeze occasionally hid the light and made it look like secret code. Colonel Fielder couldn't know it, but the danger was all over. Oahu was perfectly safe this gusty, squally night. The island's 160,000 people of Japanese blood pulled no sabotage, probably no important espionage. Even Dr. Mori's phone call to Tokyo Friday night, when he talked so mysteriously of poinsettias, hibiscuses, and chrysanthemums, may have been above board. He always claimed it was just an atmosphere piece for the Tokyo newspaper Yomiuri Shimbun, and certainly the interview did appear in the paper the following morning, complete with reference to flowers. Actually, Consul General Kita didn't need outside intelligence help. He had more than 200 consular agents, and he himself could get a perfect view of the fleet any time he chose to take a 10-minute drive. Nor was there any danger from the great Japanese task force north of Oahu. Admiral Nagumo's ships were 500 miles away, pounding silently home, steaming through the heavy mist, slightly south of their outbound course. The crews were strangely quiet. Down in the Akagi's engine room, Commander Tanbo's men didn't even take a ceremonial drink of sake. He later learned this was typical. The men whooped it up only over the small, insignificant victories. The big ones always left them sober and reflective. The Japanese submarines south of Oahu were no threat either. Most of them had lapsed into the role of observers. Commander Katsuji Watanabe casually studied Pearl Harbor from the conning tower of the I-69, lying several miles offshore. He watched the flames still licking the Arizona, and at 9:10 p.m. noted a heavy explosion aboard her. This respite was welcome, for the commander had spent a hard day dodging destroyers. Some of them probably thought they had sunk him, for Watanabe was a master at deception. He would pump out made-to-order oil slicks, and as final conclusive evidence of his destruction, he liked to jettison Japanese sandals into the sea. Lieutenant Hashimoto aboard the I-24 reflected on the change one day had made in the shoreline. The twinkling lights were all gone. Oahu was now just a gloomy shadow. The I-24 turned east and hurried off for her rendezvous with Ensign Sakamaki's midget. The whole special attack unit was to reassemble at a point 7 miles southwest of Lanai, and one by one the mother subs arrived. All night long they waited, riding gently up and down in the ocean swell, within easy sight of each other. No midgets ever appeared. On the I-24 it was discovered that Sakamaki never expected to come back. His belongings were neatly rolled up. His farewell note, with the fingernail and lock of hair, lay ready to be mailed. There were complete instructions what to do, including some yen for the postage. But Sakamaki was not dead. After his collapse at dusk, the midget cruised lazily eastward by itself. At some point he must have recovered long enough to surface and open the hatch. In any case, when he finally came to around midnight, he noticed first the moonlight, then a soothing breeze that filtered down from above. He poked his head out the hatch and gulped the cool night air. Seaman Inagaki woke up and also took a few deep breaths, but he was still groggy and soon fell back to sleep. Sakamaki stayed awake, drinking in the night, letting the sub go where it wanted. The sea wasn't rough, but an occasional wave washed his face. Stars twinkled through the drifting clouds, and moonlight danced off the water. He began having dangerous thoughts for a man on a suicide mission. He got to thinking it was good to be alive. About dawn, the motor stopped, and the midget just drifted. As the light grew brighter, Sakamaki saw a small island to the left. He decided it was Lanai, a remarkable display of faith in the sub's ability to steer itself. Actually, the boat had drifted far off course, rounded the eastern end of Oahu, and was now heading northwest along the windward side of the island. Sakamaki shook Inagaki awake and pointed out the land. They might still be in time for the rendezvous. He ordered full speed ahead. The sub started and stopped again. White smoke poured from the batteries. They were just about shot. Sakamaki waited a few minutes, like a man attempting to start a car on a low battery, and tried again. Nothing happened. Once more, the motor caught and the midget bolted ahead. Almost instantly there was another jolt, a frightful scraping, a shuddering stop. They had run her onto a reef again. This time they were stuck for good. There was nothing to do but scuttle the sub. It carried explosives for just this emergency, and Sakamaki quickly lit the fuse. For a few seconds he and Inagaki watched it splutter to make sure it didn't go out. Then they scrambled up the hatch. They climbed out on the cigar-shaped hull, wearing only G-string and loincloth. The moon was sinking in the west, a new day lighting up the eastern sky. Around them, the surf foamed and pounded. About 200 yards ahead, they could just make out a dark, empty beach. Sakamaki had a final pang of conscience. Shouldn't he stay with the midget? Was this the way of a naval officer? Then he thought, why not try to live? He was not a weapon, but a human being. He bade the sub goodbye, almost as though it were a person. We're leaving now. Explode gloriously.